This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I thought that since this marks the 450th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, I would spend a little time with you looking at Shakespeare's use of flowers in his poetry and plays. Commentators on Shakespeare are agreed that he was the greatest and most versatile writer the world has yet seen. His knowledge of plants was that which every man may have, but Shakespeare's eyes were always open to the beauties of nature, and he did not content himself with merely looking, but tried to find out the inner meaning of the beauty he saw. He had the gift of describing what he saw in a way few others could, not by long descriptions, but by a few simple words, a few well-chosen epithets. This passage was written by Doris Hunt, who wrote the book The Flowers of Shakespeare that I'll be drawing upon, and the foreword is by her friend Flora Robinson. And with a name like Flora, how could she write without writing about flowers? Doris goes on to say, in his plays, poems, and sonnets, Shakespeare names 180 different plants, but he never does so unnecessarily. They all come before us in the most natural way, as if that particular flower was the only one that could be named on that occasion. He was not a botanist, and mostly uses old English words such as daisy, lady's smock, or marigold, except in the cases where names are derived from the old French, which had superseded some of the native tongue, as we see in eglantine and chamomile. It must be appreciated that London in those days was more rural than urban. There would have been many gardens, and Shakespeare could have been familiar with the orchards and not gardens of the time. Just as the architecture of Tudor times was changing from the medieval castles and monasteries to the red brick chimneyed houses of peaceful living, so the gardens changed, but perhaps more slowly. The garden still retained surrounding walls for protection. The alley walks, which were planted with trees with climbers entwining overhead, and the bowers or arbors, which gave the sense of security. These small arbors where lovers met in secret should not be confused with summer houses such as the Princess's Pavilion in Love's Labour's Lost. The royal pavilions and those belonging to the wealthy were elaborate affairs for use of the ladies in summer, where they could embroider and enjoy music. They were also large enough to hold a banquet. There are even descriptions of these built with chimneys and up to 3 stories high. Perhaps the rooms indoors were not too pleasant in the summer, since there was too much attention paid to scented plants. The curious knot gardens of formal pattern were bordered with sweetbriar, musk rose, and honeysuckle, while underfoot were chamomile, burnet, and thyme. Shakespeare shows his knowledge of gardening by his many allusions to pruning, grafting, and manuring, in addition to weeds, blights, and frosts. Flora Robson, in her foreword, comments that flowers have been called the poetry of God. And then she goes on to say, I was named Flora by my Scottish parents, so perhaps that is why my imagination is colored by the beauty of flowers. I still remember my first gift, the top of a large dahlia. I was staying on a country holiday near the Lake District in a thatched cottage. In the garden below was a gardener who threw up to me the special dahlia. That memory of joy goes back over 70 years. And then she tells how, when she started voice training, she first read and understood an excerpt from Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck and the Fairy. And I serve the fairy queen to dew her orbs upon the green. The cowslips tall her pensioners be. I must go seek some dewdrops here and hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear. And then from the winter's tale, she remembers the joy of flowers and nature. When daffodils begin to peer with high the doxy or the dale, why then comes the sweet of the year, for the red blood rains in water pail. There are many such songs of flowers that Shakespeare must have known in his gardens at Stratford-on-Avon. The Winter's Tale is one of his last plays in which he wrote when he retired to Stratford. This must have given color to Perdita's flowers. Reverend sirs, for you, there's rosemary and rue. These keep seeming and savor all winter long. Grace and remembering you both. The fairest flowers of our season are carnations and streaked gillyflowers. I played Paulina in this play with not a word of poetry in her lines, but she was a highly satisfactory part to play, as honest as she was gormless, like a persistent bad conscience. What, sir, I did not well. Well, I meant well. So in that play, I listened to the flower poetry, but had no chance to speak it. There's rosemary, that's for remembrance, and there's pansies, that's for thoughts. Fennel, columbines, rue, daisy, violets. Writers like Bernard Shaw criticized Shakespeare because he did not write about his own times and because the stories were taken from foreign scripts. But the flowers, they come from Elizabethan England, from the gardens around Avon, or from the beautiful gardens around London where he worked. This book brings them all to mind, the flowers and the poetry. And then from an essay by an acquaintance of mine called Shakespeare and His Gardening Knowledge by Beatrice Beck. Shakespeare would have been familiar with two types of gardens, the stately, magnificent gardens that embellished the castles and manor houses of the nobility and the gentry, and the small, simple gardens such as he himself had at Stratford-on-Avon and Anne Hathaway's cottage. Every Anglo-Saxon gentleman had a garth, or garden, for pleasure, or an ortgarth, for vegetables. Garth is spelled G-A-R-T-H, by the way. In the garth, the best-loved flower was the lily, which bloomed beside the rose, sunflower, marigold, gillyflower, dianthus, carnation, wallflower, or stock, periwinkle, honeysuckle, daisy, peony, and bay tree. And she goes on to say, some of the features seen in the Tudor garden were gateways, either of pieced ironwork or wood artistically cut into balusters, and flowers with steps leading to the top so one could overlook the garden with its surrounding countryside. And within this garden were rustic arches, seats, vases, jars, fountains, dovecots, sundials, terraces, hedges, paths, borders, edgings, rock gardens, carved wooden animals, and used throughout the 16th and 17th centuries. Plans may still be seen in garden books. Shakespeare was not a botanist, although it is conjectured that at some time during the obscured years of 1584 to 92, he may have practiced as an apothecary. He was not a man skilled in technical knowledge of plants. Had his attention been fastened upon plants and flowers, however, and he had written a scientific book about them, we might have lost that wonderful body of literature by a poet who has copiously mentioned plants more often than any other single writer. Well, there's a lot that I could say further about Shakespeare and flowers, and I hope to do that with you in the next Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon.